radioalbion.com.
Well, that's the round table. We dance where we're able. We do routines and corner scenes to footwork in bed cable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot.
Hello and welcome to the Radio Albion Round Table. Today's date is Monday the 23rd of December 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. Well, we haven't had one of these for a few years now, I think, and I thought it would be fun to have one this year. We did invite Dr. Johnson along, but it seems he's overlaid. But I do have at least one co-host with me today. Perhaps Dr. Johnson will arrive later. I do have with me Grandpa Lampshade, who we haven't heard from for a week because I was unable to do a Daily Nationalist last Friday. Grandpa, how are you doing today? Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Oh, Merry Christmas to you. All is not lost. I am here. I guess that's good or bad. Just depending on the listeners' taste in entertainment. It's great to get together. We haven't had we do our Friday Daily Nationalist, but we haven't shot for a general round table discussion in a lot of years, and it's always a lot of fun. So kind of excited to have the opportunity to do it again.
Yeah, well, I thought it would be good to just sort of have a look back over the year and try and find some positive news stories, because it's very easy to get depressed and think, oh, all is lost and everything's terrible and the sky's falling in on our heads, and it's not always like that. I think we had quite a good year in 2019 when you look back at it. Obviously it was not as good as the year where Donald Trump was standing for election. I mean, that was a fantastic year. I think that was 2017, wasn't it? But 2019 was a good year, particularly a good year for Britain, I think. I mean, the first subject that I wanted to bring up was Theresa May losing her job and snivelling on the steps of Downing Street. I mean, this woman just refused to go. I think there were three attempts to get rid of her. She was so arrogant, she called a general election and lost the Conservatives the majority that they had. They had to go into a coalition. She totally ignored her Brexit secretary and the Brexit department that had been working on a Brexit deal and said, oh, no, I've got a much better deal that I've been doing in secret behind your backs, which caused the Brexit cabinet to all resign. And of course, her deal was an absolute dog's dinner. Nobody wanted it. And gradually, Conservatives kept resigning from their positions and saying that they just could not support her Brexit deal. They could no longer support her. And still, she refused to go. There was a vote of no confidence that was held. But of course, the Conservatives couldn't vote for that because it meant that Jeremy Corbyn would get in. Eventually, I think the Monday Club, who are a right-leaning part of the Conservative Party, and I think they're actually named after Mussolini's March on Rome, which I think they would rather people quietly forgot about, but they were the ones that were actually responsible for getting her finally to go. And I know it's a mean thing to say, but to see her bursting into tears on the steps of Downing Street, I mean, that really just summed up everything that was wrong with her. She was calling herself strong and stable, and she wasn't. She was weak and pathetic. She just didn't have that drive to carry through this Brexit deal. I mean, women are not very good at making deals. Feminists will tell you that. They will say that the reason why women don't get paid as much is because they're no good at arguing their case for making deals. So just on the gen side of it, she was the very worst person to put in charge of Brexit. Also, she voted to stay within the EU. She also presided over the largest influx of foreigners into the country that we've had since the Norman invasion. And to see her just pathetically bursting into tears and saying, well, I really did my best. And, well, your best wasn't good enough, was it, Theresa May? You know, we need results. This is the thing with women. They will take emotional feels as being more important than actual results. Andrea Leadsom, also another MP, she was saying, well, Theresa May has worked very hard at this, but, you know, it doesn't matter. If she's worked very hard at it, yet she's failed to score a goal, as it were, then she's still lost. Yes, she may have worked hard at it, but she didn't succeed. She was a complete failure. So I was overjoyed to see that she was finally gone. What are your thoughts about Theresa May, Grandpa? I'm sure they're probably somewhat similar to mine.
She worked hard for what exactly? I mean, there's no way to look at Theresa May's tenure as anything besides an unmitigated disaster. But why would anybody be surprised at this? She was against Brexit from the beginning. I mean, the only reason they held the Brexit vote is they thought they would win. That's the only reason they made that blunder. And then when the people actually voted to leave the EU, well, then they were in a crisis. So they put her in there, and she was never for Brexit in the first place. So how do you take somebody who's not for Brexit and they're going to negotiate some wondrous Brexit deal that people are happy with? That's absolute no-brainer. It's a non-starter. You've got somebody that on principle is against it to begin with. Well, of course they're not going to do a great job at implementing it. She wasn't for it. I think her job, as she saw it, when she says she worked very hard, well, she worked very hard at stalling it. And in that sense, she did a good job because she did. She stalled it for seemed like an eternity. She just stalled it, you know, because they didn't know what to do. I mean, they had the Brexit vote and they've gone around and claimed, you know, our values are the will of the people and the democracy and our government is for the people, by the people. But then the people voted for something that they didn't think they would. They didn't get the result they wanted, so they didn't know what to do. So the only thing they came up with was stall for time and look for excuses of why it can't be done. She comes up with this deal that, as you say, everybody hated. Even the Remainers hated it. You know, the Brexit people hated it. Nobody liked this deal. It was a stupid deal. And it was essentially Brexit in name only. Nobody liked this thing. But all she was doing was she was working hard at was stalling. Stalling for time, stall. Maybe the people forget about it. Maybe we can get a court to decide that it's illegal to go with the vote, the will of the people. Maybe Brexit is the Hotel California. You know, you can check in anytime you like, but you can never leave, like the old Eagles song. You know, but they were just stalling for time. And then they basically continue to stall for time. But the longer they do this, the more ridiculous it looks. Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm not an expert when it comes to British politics, but from what I do know, this was her role. She was never for it, so she was stalling for time. She comes up with this horrible deal that nobody likes, more stalling, more foot dragging. It amazes me because so many things came up when all of this was happening. You know, oh, we can't leave without a deal. Well, why? Why can't you leave without it? It can't be done. Why not? You know, I mean, you existed as an independent nation before joining the EU. It shouldn't be that hard to go back and say, well, we're just going to basically pick up where we left off when we made this horrible decision to join the European Union. They act like it's this complete, oh my gosh, it's so complicated. These things are so complicated, it can't be done. But it's not. It's really not that complicated. You just simply go back where you were and say, well, we're going to pick up our policies, implement everything back where we were before we decided to join. It's not that difficult. But she never intended to do it. She was just stalling for time, hoping to find some way out of it. Now, where she would, you know, as far as that being her mission, where she did fail is she failed to adequately find a way out of it, because the more they stalled, the more they spit on the will of the people, the more the people were hard and determined that, yeah, they do want a Brexit. I think more people were for Brexit today than when the original vote happened. And I think that is due in no small part to the actions of people like Theresa May.
Yeah, she certainly worked very hard for the EU. And she did actually say, I think it was about 120 times, she said no deal is better than a bad deal, and then refused to leave without a deal. But once she was gone, I mean, you were just pointing out there that more people are now supportive of leaving the EU than were before. And I think that's just been shown with the recent election that we had, which is another one on my list of great things that have happened this year. And I never thought I would say it. I really wasn't that excited about the election. And I thought, well, there's really not that much difference. Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, they both love immigration. They both want to open up the borders. get as many people in as they can possibly get away with. And so I was really pleasantly surprised to get up on Friday morning and see that just about every single one of the Brexit saboteurs had lost their seat. I mean, that was just wonderful to behold. The MP from Hope Not Hate, she lost her seat. Luciana Berger, she lost her seat. Anna Soubry lost her seat. Dominic Grieve lost his seat. The Speaker of the House resigned before he could be pushed. Chuck Aramana, he lost his seat. It was just amazing. All these horrible, horrible, horrible people that have been trying to sabotage Brexit for the last 3 years that assumed that the country was behind them and the country was supporting them because they never come out of their liberal bubble, the metropolitan bubble that they have in London. They never actually speak to anybody that's outside of London. So they had an absolute shock to find that they were all kicked out. And in their place, the Conservatives won a massive majority with 80 seats, a huge majority, which made me think, you know, okay, Brexit was a part of it. But I also think a part of it was the way that Boris Johnson was portrayed as being an extreme right-wing politician with extreme right-wing views. Of course, he isn't. He's just a centrist. In fact, he's probably centre-left. But, you know, he does go along with these ideas of Islamophobia and we want more immigration and diversity is a strength. I mean, he goes along with all of that, which I would say is left-wing views. But at the same time, he is pro-Brexit and he is going to get Brexit done. And he was portrayed in the press as being a white supremacist, being a Nazi, being a fascist. David Lammy, Black MP, had called him a fascist and a Nazi. And Jacob Rees-Mogg, his right-hand man, who I think's an amazing, amazingly adept politician, really, really articulate. He's fantastic to see in the interviews. He actually won over half the vote. He won more votes than every other party put together and added up against him. And he literally won more votes than that. And the left are screaming about it because they call him Lord Snooty. And they're like, you know, what are the working classes doing supporting this man? But he's brilliant. He's a really good politician. He's the sort of guy we want leading. Unfortunately, he's not leading. We've got Boris Johnson leading. So I was really pleased with the results of this election. And I'm also pleased to see one of the first things Boris Johnson has done is wheel back on a promise to have an inquiry into Islamophobia. And he has said that the reason why we're going to pull back on this, the guy that was going to investigate it looks like he's got some kind of bias. And the very word Islamophobia itself has a bias against discrimination against everybody else. So we're going to have an inquiry into discrimination all round. We're not just going to specify Islamophobia, which is, you know, it's only a small thing. But, you know, the way I look at it, I'm not expecting Boris Johnson to do any wonderful things for white people or any wonderful things for Britain. But I am looking at it that he's probably going to do some small things which help us in some smaller ways, like limiting immigration with his points-based system or limiting the sort of immigrants that come over that just want to get benefits or they just want to commit crimes. At least there's going to be a reduction in that. I would hope there would be a little bit more free speech. I think he's going to be a little bit more like Donald Trump. I think we have to take these small blessings and be thankful for them because there is so much bad stuff that goes on around us. We just have to, you know, hone in on these small things and be thankful for them. What did you make of the election, Grandpa?
Well, nobody is more pessimistic about the voting and the democracy than yours truly. But one of the things these votes, these elections do provide is, I think, kind of a snapshot of the mood of the people. I think there's a lot. And again, I'm not claiming to be an expert on British politics. You know far more about that than I do for obvious reasons. But yeah, there were a lot of things at play here. I mean, first off, this was a second Brexit vote. I mean, they could try to paint it however they want to, that it was a second Brexit vote. And you had so many people so upset just for the fact that the people voted for Brexit and yet they ignored it. I mean, they just spit all over it. And so you had that. We can't also forget how many of these people lost their seats were a part of this. You remember the whole, the coup attempt with this shadow government they were openly talking about, just basically ignoring all of the rules and appointing themselves in charge. You had all of that going on, which you have to believe that doesn't play well with the people. I think it's funny that they're asking, what has Boris Johnson done for the working class? What are the working class people doing? Well, what has the leftists in Britain actually done for the working class? I mean, really, they sit here and say, oh, well, these people over here in the Conservative Party, they haven't done anything for them. But they haven't done any. The left hasn't. The Labour Party doesn't do anything for the working class. All they do is basically import more people to keep wages down to compete against the working class. It's an utter joke. And at some point in time, people become aware of this. And as far as their rhetoric, this constant calling everybody, you know, fascist, Nazi, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Some of that is, it's just finally just losing its effectiveness because they're using it so much. But maybe, this is also a fact, but the thing they're not considering is, as they call all these people extreme right wingers, even though they're not, maybe the fact that the people are voting for them anyway is an indicator that as they continue to push these policies that the people are not for, that perhaps maybe the people are warming up to something more right wing. Maybe the people are really warming up to something much more nationalist as far as leadership they know he's not really a hardcore nationalist right-wing person, but maybe the people in a way with this vote are saying that, things are so bad, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing after all. And you have to think that idea scares them more than anything.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I really do think that's what it is. I mean, that's what we see happening all over Europe. You know, you got this populist wave, you got the alternative for Deutschland, who are the opposition in some parts of Germany, and they're the third party in parliament throughout the rest of Germany. You've got the Party of the Swedes, the alternative for Sweden. They're doing very well. You had Matteo Salvini, who was in coalition government for quite some time, and then they found some way to cheat and get rid of him, but he's still the most popular politician in Italy. So you've got Donald Trump over there in America. So that there is a drive towards populism and even towards civic nationalism. I mean, I would take civic nationalism as being much better than what we have now. Even if it's people that are just doing what's best for the country, even civic nationalists understand that there needs to be limits on immigration. And it's interesting that you brought up that coup that they were planning there, because they were accusing Boris Johnson of trying to pull a coup, and they were the ones that were talking about having a so-called unity government made up of all the losers in the Brexit vote, and arguing over who they were going to parachute in as prime minister. And they'd even got the courts involved as well. They politicized the courts. They got Tony Blair's Supreme Court that he arranged for that had no oversight. I mean, nobody that was put on that Supreme Court was checked to see what their political views were. So, of course, they were all leftists and feminists, and they interfered where they shouldn't have done, claiming that Boris Johnson's plan to prorogue Parliament was unlawful because he had more than one reason for doing it. And under those standards, every single proroguing of Parliament for the last century would have been considered illegal. I mean, they really were pulling out all the stops. We had the Speaker of the House, John Bercow, who kept breaking with tradition, breaking the Constitution, making the rules up as he went along, allowing the opposition in Parliament to table motions and take control of what was going on. It's the party in power who is supposed to set the timetable and say, look, this is what we're going to be discussing today. But this turncoat of a speaker, this John Bercow, he allowed the opposition to do that. So there are all these dirty tricks that were going on, and it was just absolutely glorious to see them all effectively get the sack, basically, and in such a massive way that the Conservatives won 80 seats, something which they hadn't done for decades, basically, not since the time of Margaret Thatcher, when she was riding very high, and the Labour Party hadn't lost that many seats since the 1930s. So in a way, democracy was vindicated on Friday. The closest thing we had to a nationalist politician was voted in. The Labour Party, that just seemed to be interested in SJW issues like diversity and apologising for colonialism, gender studies, feminism, all that sort of stuff, that was roundly rejected by their voting base, which is the working class. And the working class changed to supporting the Conservatives. And you say, well, what have Labour done, or what have the Conservatives done for the working class? Well, they may not have done much, but at least they haven't harmed them. At least they haven't started replacing them and parachuting in foreigners into their villages and turfing them out of their homes so they can put refugees in them. These are all policies that the Labour Party were pushing for. So absolutely fantastic news, I think, that election was. It really couldn't actually have gone any better, because, you know, we didn't actually have any nationalist parties that were competing. So I think the general public just went for the closest thing that they could get to a nationalist politician, which was Boris Johnson. So it's definitely a sign of good things to come. But I really didn't want to just concentrate on things that were happening in Britain. There was some interesting stuff that was happening on the continent as well. I don't know if you want to move on to that, Grandpa, or do you want to add some more comments on the election and Brexit and the rest of what's happening in Britain first?
Well, I mean, you brought up a good point, which is that the Labour Party in this case, the leftists in Britain, and this is kind of a good jump off point here, because this actually, you know, can transcend beyond just Britain, but here in America, and I believe worldwide. And that is that these leftists, when I mean leftist, I don't mean old school. That's why I hate the term liberals. People here in America will say these liberals, and they're not liberals. I'm old enough to remember what liberals were. Liberals were actually closer to what we would call libertarians today. I mean, they were concerned about issues like free speech. They were concerned about issues like, you know, government overreach into people's personal lives. Those were liberals. These people we deal with now here in America or in Britain or in Europe, they're not liberals. They're commies. I call them commies because when you get down to it, that's what they are. And you brought up a good point that all these people in the Labour Party in this instance, you know, all they were standing for is, as you put it, SJW causes, you know, apologizing for colonial, you know, we're so horrible. You know, and you see these people's views reflected as far as those who do hold that view, the rank and file. The supporters, I call them here. There's a term I've been seeing in the media. It's called cancel culture. I've added commie to it. The cancel culture commies. And there are these people that, you know, because on social media, like Twitter, for instance, they've banned everybody not a leftist pretty much now. So, you know, when there's a big Twitter storm about it, it's all these cancel culture commies. And they're going around now attacking people who are just like minor celebrity. I mean, I'm not talking about right-wing people at all. I saw an article about some singer. I have no idea who she is, but apparently she's popular over here. And I think she's a Cuban or something. And they dug up a tweet she did when she was 15 or 16 years old, criticizing, you know, making fun of Mexicans. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's racist. And they attack her. You know, and I find it interesting. And you look at this and you say, well, this is a negative. Well, it is, but it's, when you look at it in the bigger picture of things, which I constantly try to do because it's the only way I can find a silver lining. When you look at the big picture of things, they've been screaming at nationalists for years now. They call us evil Nazis. We're just, you know, all these crazy. But the fact of the matter is that when you look at the people as a whole of the country, they're not sick of nationalists. They're sick of these cancel culture commies. They're sick, and this is reflected in what you're talking about there with the Labour Party. All they're standing for is the cancel culture stuff, the screaming at anybody who says anything that could be remotely viewed as offensive to somebody somewhere. You know, these SJW causes. These are the people that the masses are sick and tired of. It's their endless screeching, their endless harping, their endless posturing as everybody's moral superiors. People are getting beyond sick of it. They're not sick of nationalism. We're at the point now, we've already covered, they call Boris Johnson a right-wing Nazi fascist you know, whatever. And it doesn't register anymore. People are sick of the name calling. They realize they're sick of these people. They're sick of these people who go around and tell everybody that it's your fault. The world sucks because of you. Forget the civilization that we enjoy, that our ancestors built and you know, something we should be proud of. Forget all that. The world sucks, and it sucks because of you. It sucks because of who you are, who your people are, the nation you're a part of. The people are really, really, really getting sick of it. And I think that's a view, again, that can be looked at universally, worldwide, here in America, here, you know, like say there in Britain, in Europe. The people are sick and tired of these cancel culture people who can't find anything good to say about anybody. Any, you know, they eat their own on a regular basis. At some point in time, if you're going to rally the support of the masses, you have to offer them something. One of the things that gave the actual Bolshevik, the communist movement back in, you know, the early 1900s, I mean, they stood for something. They lied, but they promised the workers who were being exploited by the wealthy industrialists. The workers were being exploited beyond belief. We hear constantly about the horrors of slavery, but if you look into the child labor and the conditions of these factories back in the early 1900s, these people were being horribly exploited. If you died on the job, they didn't care. They got another person they'll throw in to the machine. They didn't care. The communists offered the working people, look, you're being exploited. We'll stand up for you. We'll represent you. We will create a workers' paradise. And granted, it was a lie, but they were offering something. The point is, they were offering something. They didn't, you know, that's why you had these communist labor unions that would get out on the streets and you know, because they had legitimate complaints, and the communists of that day were offering something to them for these legitimate complaints. What are these cancel culture commies offering the people? As we've already said, what has labor in Britain done for the working class people? Nothing. Nothing. None of these SJW type leftists, these commies, they're not offering people anything. All they're offering the people is lecturing them that they themselves are your moral superiors. The world sucks because of you. You really are the problem. And you should hate your nation, you should hate your people, and you should hate your culture and your heritage. That's it. And I'm sorry, I don't care how loud they scream. I don't care how much they dominate the media, how much everybody else has been kicked off of social media so they can amplify their voices as though they are a reflection of the will of the people. They're not. They're not offering the people anything. And I think the people worldwide are really getting sick and tired of these people.
They are our best recruiters. I mean, I've said this for quite some time now, that, you know, we don't need to go out trying to convince people that we are correct. And if you try to push your opinion onto somebody, most of the time they will just dig in. And you can tell them all the facts in the world, but if they don't want to know, they don't want to know. But what does actually wake them up is when they're watching things like the BBC or they're reading the mainstream media, and they see people that they can tell are good people, and they're being attacked, and they're being smeared, and they're being slandered. Our history is smeared and slandered. We're told that we should be feeling guilty for helping these people out in the third world. We're told we should be feeling guilty for colonialism. And they'll give space to people that are trying to do things like pull down statues of Cecil Rhodes when they're actually on a Cecil Rhodes scholarship. And if it wasn't for Cecil Rhodes, they wouldn't even be at the university. Things like that are what push people towards us. I mean, people like Tommy Robinson, that is constantly slandered and smeared in the press. It's that very slandering and that very smearing of somebody like Tommy Robinson and the exaggerations that they make about him that pushes people towards us. And then they find us and then they support us. So, you know, in a way, I see the mainstream media and the BBC and all the rest of it and all these shrill voices standing up for all these SJW causes, they are fantastic recruiters for us. We don't need to go out there trying to convince people of what we are doing, that what we are doing is right. They will realize that when they just watch the BBC News or if they watch the Channel 4 News. And I watch talk shows in the morning. There's a talk show that I watch And this year, there have been lots of people on there challenging the panel's opinion. I mean, they have a panel there, and it's supposed to have a diversity of opinion. Sometimes they will have someone that's supposed to be right-wing on there, but most of the time, it's just all left-wingers, or all left-wingers and one that pretends to be on the right. And people will phone up, and they will just, you know, they'll let rip at the whole panel. And say that, no, this is totally wrong. We don't want any of these terrorists back in Britain. No, we don't want Jemima Begum back in Britain. She's a terrorist. She went over there to support terrorists. You know, things like that. And you've got the whole panel that are saying, oh, well, we should bring her back, really. She was groomed and all this sort of stuff that they will say, which is very, very very hypocritical. So that I find has been very, very encouraging. I mean, a lot of the time, sometimes you think things are negative, but there's actually a silver lining to it. I mean, just to get a little bit philosophical here and theological, you know, that's the way that God works. You know, bad things happen and good things happen at the end of it. I mean, that's what you learn from the Bible, because, you know, looking at things from an eternal perspective is going to be different to looking at things from life on earth. So we may see something that's, you know, that we think is horrible, but the collective result of that in some years' time may actually be pretty positive. But as I said, I wanted to look at something else that happened in Europe this year that I was really, really encouraged by, and this was an initiative of Viktor Orbán, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who we've mentioned a lot here at Radio Albion. We're big fans of Viktor Orbán. We know that Hungarians themselves may not be so pleased with him, the same as Russians may not be so pleased with Putin, and that's a symptom of the grass is always greener. When you don't actually have a politician like that in your own country, then they can seem amazing. But when you've had them all along, then you tend to become a bit jaded to what they're actually doing. But I think Viktor Orbán really set the standard this year, because he had a conference, a family values conference, and I've got a quote here about it. This is from The Guardian. Procreate or face extinction. That is the message from Central European leaders to their shrinking populations as across the region, right-wing governments implement family-first policies to incentivize childbearing. Hungary's government is holding an international summit on demography in Budapest this week, and that was back in September, being attended by several regional leaders and delegations from dozens of countries in an attempt to trumpet their investment in family policies. The country's nativist Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, said it was conceivable that Hungary, with a population of just under 10 million that is shrinking due to low birth rates and immigration of Hungarians to EU states further west, could simply disappear. It's not hard to imagine that there would be one single last man who has to turn the lights out, he said at the opening of the conference. Orbán said other European politicians saw immigration as the solution, but he firmly rejected this. If Europe is not going to be populated by Europeans in the future, and we take this as a given, then we are speaking about an exchange of populations to replace the population of Europeans with others, said Orbán. There are political forces in Europe who want a replacement of population for ideological or other reasons. So he is confirming there that this is replacement migration that we have. The UN called it replacement migration, and we're being told, oh, this is just a conspiracy theory that you are being replaced. Well, here we have the leader of a country telling us that there are leaders in Europe who are deliberately trying to replace their populations. Now, if that wasn't good enough, the guest of honour at this conference was an ex-Australian Prime Minister. Orbán's words were backed up by one of the guests of honour at the summit, the former Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott, who saluted the Hungarian leader for having the political courage to defy political correctness. Abbott said dying populations, not climate change, were the biggest threat to Western civilization, and lashed out at Prince Harry and Meghan Markle for remarks that they would not be having more than two children due to the effects on the environment. Abbott said, having fewer children in Western countries will hardly make the climate better when so many children are being born elsewhere. And that is amazing to me, because, you know, this is what we've been saying for years now, and this is now mainstream. This is the ex-Prime Minister of Australia saying this, and he was a prime minister within the last 10 years, I think, a fairly recent prime minister that is talking absolute sense here, that instead of ostracizing Viktor Orban, he's saluting him. Orban is putting in all these policies to encourage the Hungarians to produce more children. He's saying this is going on. This replacement migration, it is a thing, and I am standing up to this. And to me, this was just amazing to see. This is a country that's a part of the EU, and they're confirming everything that we know to be the truth, and they are taking a stand against this. There were lots of other countries there from Eastern Europe and Central Europe that had representatives there at this conference. And I think that's probably the most positive thing to hear this year, that there are actually countries in Europe who are taking positive steps to increase their birth rate and prevent immigrants coming in to replace them. I mean, this is the best news we could ever possibly have, I think, Grandpa. Had you heard about this before now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just want to say, I think Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's decision not to have more than two children has a whole lot more to do with her age than it does with climate change. But nonetheless, not one of the great things about this whole event was that it really put the lie to the narrative that the only answer to demographic downturns is to replace your population. And that's because that's really, when you get down to the heart of the matter, when you cut down to the bone of this thing, that's what they've said. They basically are peddling the notion that, well, you're not replacing yourselves enough, so we have to chase gross domestic product growth by importing more people. That's the only answer. There's not enough of you, so we've got to import more people. This is an absolute lie, of course. And this event really had somebody front and center speaking the truth to this lie, which it always should be a problem, regardless of, you know, your views on the people saying it. That's irrelevant. The truth is the truth. I don't care who says it. If somebody speaks the truth to the lie, then that's something to be supported. This notion that, oh, well, your demographics are in a downturn, so we're going to have to replace you. We just bring in more people. It's an absolute lie. Now, obviously, you look at a nation like Japan, for instance, who, you know, they've got a horrible demographic downturn, but yet they have resisted the calls and the urgings and the pressure to start importing the third world to replace their Japanese citizens, because they do understand that it won't be Japan anymore. And as they've, you know, as was stated here, you've already covered, if you replace the European people with Africans or Middle Easterners, I mean, it won't be Hungary anymore. It'll be Turkey or Nigeria or wherever the populations are from, Somalia, wherever the populations are from. That's what it'll be. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess you could draw the lines on the map and still call it that, but for all practical purposes, it wouldn't be that. And just to highlight how much of a lie this is, if you know, if you look at the amount of money that is spent, say in a country that does have all these people coming in, like Germany, for instance. Let's say Germany, and we'll pick on them. You know, they've imported all of these people. Supposedly, I guess the original justification is they're poor refugees fleeing the civil war in Syria, even though you had all these Africans, you had people that came from places not Syria. That was a lie to begin with. But if you look at all of these people they brought in from the third world, now, how much money have they spent on these people? They've spent billions, if not more, supporting these people. They provided them housing. They brought them here. They've cared for their every need. They've given them transportation. They've spent billions of dollars on bringing these people in. Now, what if they had taken that money and instead incentivized people to have more kids? Hey, we're going to give you this amount of money if you'll simply have more children. And that's what Orban basically came out and proposed, you know, an incentive for people to have more children. This isn't that hard. You know, and the people, you would maintain your population. You can turn, even if you did nothing except not import the third world, if you protected the people of your nation, the demographics will reverse. I mean, a lot of times these demographic downturns happen because of things like, well, housing gets expensive, you know, wages get depressed. I mean, people just feel they can't afford to have children. But as the older people die off, what do? You wind up with more available housing. Then housing gets cheaper. You know, I don't mean to sound like Mr. Free Market solves everything, but the free market in this sense kind of does act in this area. Housing will get cheaper. Well, there's fewer people as they retire from the workforce. Well, now you have more competition from jobs. So guess what happens? Wages goes up. Housing gets cheaper. Now, all of a sudden, maybe couples are like, well, you know, my wife doesn't have to work and we can afford to have more than one child. And the things can reverse on their own. But that can only happen if you maintain the homogenous population of your nation. And that's why one of the several reasons, though, that they oppose that, because they don't want wages to go up. So they want to keep the wages. They want to keep the labor pool flooded to keep those wages down. They want to keep the housing market propped up. They don't want that to reverse. And some of that is, I mean, there are other, yes, ideological things at work here. But there's also an economic one. You have these very wealthy, these corporations, banks, things such as, they want to keep the current setup. They want wages low. They want to keep the labor pool flooded. And so they don't care about the homogenous, the identity of the nation. These are things that matter nothing to them. They're international in their scope. So, yeah, I you know, the fact that they can turn around and say, hey, we're going to give an incentive for people to have more kids while not importing the third world. Of course, it's a very great thing. And again, in no small part, because it really shines the spotlight on the lie of the narrative that they've been telling everybody of why we just, it's inevitable. We just have to import the rest of the world. Otherwise, our nation will die off. It's like, if we don't take this poison, we're going to die. It's all a lie. And I thought this was a great event because it really, you have people of prominence. I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, people on the internet saying these things, but when you have people that hold a position of authority in the eyes of the people stand up and speak these truths to the lie of this narrative, it really is truly a great thing.
Well, it's not just Hungary that have done this. You know, Poland have introduced measures to increase the birth rates of Poles. They've done the same in Slovakia. They've done the same in Russia. I mean, there's been a big drive over the last 10 years, really, in Russia to increase these Russian birth rates. And of course, it gets decried over here as being racist to do this. I mean, it's not racist to try to improve the conditions of your people. I mean, you got to think about, I mean, who is your people? Who are the people from Britain? Who are the British people? They are the people that built the country. And that's who the government should be working to improve the lives of those people, not working to improve the lives of any other people. You know, they can work to improve their own lives in Pakistan or in regions of Africa. You know, if they want to come here, they should be able to come here as guests, but they certainly shouldn't be able to have any say in what the policies are, because they're just going to drive the policies towards looking out for their own interests. And we've got nobody that is looking out for our interests, apart from in these East European and Central European countries here. So yeah, I mean, that is wonderful news. I say we haven't got people that are looking out for our interests here. Now in Britain, we haven't had a nationalist party for a long time. We've got the National Front, who really their name is fairly toxic through things that happened in the 70s and the 80s, and they're probably only about 1% of the size that they actually were in the 70s. And the BNP, that's fallen apart. I mean, that's pretty much just there now in order to collect money from people, elderly people, that left their wills to the BNP back when it was a thing. And, you know, these elderly people, they may have dementia now and various other things. And apparently the BNP is pretty much just there to collect this money. They certainly don't do anything else. So we haven't really got a nationalist party in Britain. We've got Britain First. And again, Britain First have got themselves a bit of a bad name because they just seem to concentrate on Muslim bothering, upsetting the Muslims, going, you know, crashing into their mosques, walking through their areas with crosses. It's all very confrontational, and it doesn't look that good to the general British public. So I've been praying for a long time that we would get a proper, good, decent, ethno-nationalist organisation in Britain to represent the needs of the British people. And I think we saw the seeds of that this year with the Patriotic Alternative, which is Mark Cullett's inspiration. He's got his second in command there is Laura Towler, whose idea it was to go out and carry out a survey of the British public to see how the British public felt about the news that they were likely to become a minority within 40 years, which of course the mainstream press had parroted and said was a wonderful thing, that white people were going to be a minority in 40 years. But the general population weren't really aware of that. And 60 or 70% said, well, no, they don't think that's a good thing. That's actually quite concerning, which says that 60 or 70% of the population would be with a party that was going to be advocating for doing something about that. And what we need is a party that doesn't have these old trappings of these older organizations, that doesn't have a way of confronting people or confronting Muslims, and is just basically advocating for white people and putting across an acceptable face. And I think the Patriotic Alternative is going to do that. I was involved with helping to put their conference on this year, and everybody there was of a very, very high standard. I mean, all young professionals. There were some older people there as well that had been in the movement for quite some time. But on the whole, it was just very intelligent people. It wasn't the football hooligan crowd that you associate with the EDL. It wasn't the sort of tattooed skinhead crowd that you might associate with some of the older British nationalist organisations. A lot of youth there, a lot of drive, a lot of vigour. And I think with Mark Cullett leading it, I think, you know, we really do stand a good chance of having a proper nationalist movement once again in Britain. I'd like to see them become a political party, because there is a space there for that. There is a space there for a non-extremist party that speaks up for the British people. And Mark is a very articulate young man, and he has the experience. This is the thing. He has 20 years experience with nationalism, and he's under 40, which is exactly the right age that you need to be doing this sort of stuff. You need that experience, but you still need that youthful drive there as well. So that was also an extremely encouraging thing that I saw this year. And I'm sad to say it, you know, I mean, America doesn't really seem to have a Mark Cullett-like character. I mean, the closest you could probably get to that is Richard Spencer. But Richard Spencer, you know, a lot of the time he says and does silly things, and he comes across as a little bit too upper class to appeal to the more working class man. And I think Mark Cullett really does appeal to all the different classes. I would love to see some kind of movement take off over there in America. But I really just, there just doesn't seem to be anything since the National Alliance fell apart with William Pierce. The National Front, I'm not quite sure what they're doing, or not the National Front, the Northwest Front, since Harold Covington passed away. They seem to be having problems. They're not putting out as much content as they were, and they were certainly never as big as the National Alliance. So, you know, that is really encouraging for me. What do you think of that, Grandpa? And have you got any thoughts on the American movement? Do you see that's in a good place, or do you think that's going to improve at all in the next year?
Well, I think the thing that's really important that people need to remember, and I guess have a bit of patience with, is none of us know how this stuff plays out. That's why I tell people we don't know how this plays out. You do what you can. But what people need to remember is these things happen step by step. And so you got to have a little bit of patience. The people that try to start a nationalist movement, for instance, whether it's a political party or whatever, they're going to screw up along the way. And I mean, if the people supporting that have this mindset that the minute somebody screws up, minute somebody did something, looking on hindsight, that wasn't very smart, you're just going to throw them under the bus, then, you know, we're never going to get anywhere, because this is a learning experience for everybody. You know, no matter where it is, Britain, Europe, America, it's, you know, people are trying to figure this out as they go. I mean, they realize there's a problem. Now, I'm not saying that when somebody demonstrates that, you know, to put it mildly, like they're mentally unstable and they're just not going to be able to handle those duties, then, you know, you say, well, this person has demonstrated that, you know, they're not really up to the job here. You know, I mean, then, yeah, you might have to move on. But any sort of movement, you know, it's a step by step. And sometimes movements or what do I want to say, attempts at moving things in a certain direction, sometimes they utterly fail. But perhaps the next thing that comes along builds on top of that. People get this mindset. We have this instant gratification culture and society that we live in, and as is reflected in the nationalist movements, I believe, all throughout the West. People have this notion that, like, they're going to wake up one day and boom, some nationalist leader is now in power and they fix everything. End of story. You know, and that's just, I'm sorry, it's just not the way it works. It's why you see a lot of the disappointment, you know, when it comes to, like, here in America with Donald Trump. And it's like, well, the only reason you would be disappointed with Trump is if you had unrealistic expectations of what he was going to do. It's like people on the right started drinking their own Kool-Aid or whatever, you know, their own, you know, over the top memes, and started believing, like, this God Emperor stuff was true, you know, and that he was going to, like, just fix everything. And I never thought that when I was back when we were memeing him into office in 2016. I had realistic expectations. When people say, are you disappointed in Trump? It's like, well, no, because I always had realistic expectations of what, you know, him getting elected and what he was going to actually do. What that meant, what that was going to bring about. And I just think that, again, with any nationalist movement, we have to be patient and realize that people are going to change their view, not even change their views, but adjust the way they present things. Oh, well, this doesn't work, so we need to do this. And there needs to be a certain amount of patience with that. We have to say, okay, well, you know, that person, like I say, hindsight's 20/20. When you look back and say, well, that was a screw up. We shouldn't have, you know, that shouldn't have been done that way. That person shouldn't have worded that way or whatever. We have to be patient with that because we're all figuring this out as we go. Now, you know, and again, to get anywhere, you know, because I hate the mentality that, well, as soon as somebody screws up, we need to throw them under the bus, burn the whole thing down. Let's start over from scratch. All we ever do is run around in circles starting over from scratch, and we wonder why we don't get anywhere. Again, now there's sometimes that somebody starts to kind of float up and they look like, hey, they're kind of might be starting some momentum. Maybe this guy, you know, and then along the way, they kind of just go off the rails, and it's like, okay, yeah, no, this guy, you know, let's don't put too much stock in this person. That's just being prudent. That's just being, smart. But as far as movements themselves go, we need to be patient and real. This stuff is not going to happen overnight. Yes, there is a sense of urgency because those who are destroying our nations have been working on this for decades, you know, for a long, long time. And now it's coming to fruition. And now people realize it. And there's a sense of panic. But none of this is going to happen overnight. Here in America, we're stuck with the two parties. I talk to people from Britain. I talk to people from Europe. And they bemoan, you know, so you were mentioning the grass is always greener. They bemoan the multi-party system. Well, it waters down the people. Trust me, as somebody who lives in a nation that has a two-party system, it's way better to have a multi-party system than a two-party system. People sit here and say, well, it's useless trying to, you know, basically move the Republican Party. It's useless. Look, under the current system, where we're at today in this society, that's it. Every attempt at raising a third party has failed. Ross Perot tried it in the 90s, and he had billions of dollars to spend on it, and it failed. The power structure is just too entrenched. Now, as we see societal collapse play out, that could change, and I believe it will. But we don't deal with someday. We deal with what can we do today. And so, you know, that's what we're stuck with. We try, you know, we're trying to move what we can, you know, because the people closest to being traditionalists tend to support the Republican Party. And those are the people who are going to come closer to supporting nationalism. They're way far from it right now. But as they grow sick of the leftists, that they inch a little closer. A good example of this, as we talk about things with a silver lining, is this impeachment of Donald Trump. We get focused because we do try to focus on getting people in the Republican, moving the Republican Party to a more realistic stance. And it's easy to get blackpilled with it because the Republican Party, that's not their normal, that's not what they're designed to do. They're designed to be the fake opposition, and we're trying to turn them into a real opposition. And it's easy to get disgusted, blackpilled, if you were, with that. But one has served well as stepping back and looking at the Democrat Party in this country. They've gone off the rails. They've gone completely off the rails. They have, like, I don't know how many people now running for president on the Democrat ticket. And they're all, essentially, they're all lunatics. Tulsi Gabbard is the only one closest to looking sane as far as that, you know. And the Democrat Party has gone off the rails. And that has been highlighted with this impeachment fiasco. They impeached Donald Trump. They sit here and they told everybody in the American press that through these show trials with their cherry-picked witnesses to say what they wanted them to say. And they talked about, they threw huge words around, bribery, huge amount of corrupt. Oh my gosh, he was doing all of these horrible illegal things. And then they impeach him, and they impeach him on what? The vaguest terms they could find. Obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. This is like the most vague thing they could come. What happened to bribery? They were telling us it was bribery. Why didn't they go with that? So they come up with these vague terms. They impeach him. And now, after putting on what is observably a kangaroo court, as it were, of cherry picking witnesses, not allowing the Republicans to basically bring anything real, any kind of real opposition in, they railroad this impeachment in. And now, by the rules, by the tradition, it's got to go to the Senate for an actual trial. But the problem is they don't control the Senate. And now they're bemoaning, well, there might not be a fair trial in the Senate. A fair trial. Everybody has seen what a kangaroo thing this is. Even the extreme leftists that thought it was great, they're not pretending like this was some sort of fair process. They're just great that they're able, they're just high on the idea that they're able to wield this power. And this makes the impeachment of Trump, I think, a positive thing because people see it. Again, we're talking about the masses. The public sees this for the charade it is, for the lunacy that the left today presents itself as. They're talking about not even sending the articles of impeachment to the Senate. This would be like indicting somebody, making a public announcement that we have indicted this person for these heinous crimes, but we're not going to send the indictment up to be prosecuted. You would just sit there and say, then it's not really, it's nothing. It's not even, and what are you talking about? You said you indicted them because they did these horrible things, but you're not going to have a trial? That would be absurd on his face. And that is what the Democrats are doing today. And it has just really just, again, shone the spotlight on these people. They are off the rails. And more, I believe, it turns the people off. The public aren't going to support that. The public, I mean, yeah, hardcore lefties just live in the world of Orange Man Bad. They'll think it's great. But you were never going to convince them anyway. The public at large see this, and they're turned off by it. And it just, as we already covered, just like he saw the support swell up for Boris Johnson in Britain, because the people were turned off by things like this attempted coup with a shadow government, the thwarting of the will of the people with the Brexit vote. People are turned off by this, by the fact that it's the wrong guy won. They're not happy that Trump won. If it would have been Jeb versus Hillary and Jeb would have won, they wouldn't be nearly this butthurt. They had cherry-picked what the outcome was supposed to be, and they didn't get that. And they're still, to this day, trying to overturn an election.
Sore losers, that's what it is, isn't it? Sore losers. And I completely agree with you there, Grandpa. I think this impeachment fiasco is going to do nothing but help Donald Trump. I think he's going to win that election again in 2 years' time, probably by a landslide, similar to Boris Johnson winning this one. And also, I take your point there about it takes time to build up a movement. And that is, again, something that I have to credit Mark with doing, because that's what he's been doing with his podcast that started off this week on the alt-right, and now it's the Patriotic Weekly Review, and it's gradually built up the listeners, and then he's gradually – working on getting those listeners offline and meeting up in real life, and then building a movement out of it. So there's been a progression right from the start. It was never just about entertaining people with podcasts. And it does take time to build these things. And I think the people that get into trouble for extremism, a lot of them, they're just impatient. And they say, well, we haven't got anything, and nobody's doing anything for us now. And that's it. We haven't got any other chance. We've got to have revolution now. And, you know, that's not the way things are. We've got 40 years in which to do something in Britain, and it will take time to build a movement, and it will take time to build a movement in America. The one good thing I would say about your system, Grandpa, is that at least somebody like Donald Trump could become president. I mean, we are told over here, and we know it's a nonsense, but anybody could become president, and that's the great thing about America. But it's not anybody. But if you have got enough money, you could get there. You could get in there. And Donald Trump proved that. Whereas over here, we don't get a chance to actually vote for the leader of the government. We end up voting for MPs. We end up voting for parties, but we don't actually vote for the leader of the party. No, nobody gets a chance to vote for the prime minister. They have to vote for the party itself. So this idea of moving into the Republican Party and then turning it into a real defense for our people, I think that is a good idea. Over here, there's something similar going on, which is quite hilarious, which is in the news at the moment. Britain First members are all signing up to join the Conservative Party, and they want to form a movement within the Conservative Party to keep it heading towards the right, in the same way that Momentum, this left-wing group, all joined up with Labour and then pushed it to the left, and which is a great thing. And of course, the journalists are all shrieking about it, that Britain First members are joining the Conservative Party. But I think that's great. You know, all these positive things that people are doing to advocate for our people and to keep pushing for better conditions for us, and a halt to immigration and an increase in our numbers to prevent us from going extinct. All these things are going on. And, you know, I am very encouraged by a lot of what I have seen this year. I think 2020 is going to continue going in that direction. I am looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to more Radio Albion programs this week, but we're going to have to finish this one. Thank you very much for coming on today, Grandpa. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back with An Ear in Britannia next Monday with Max Masson. So until then, I hope you'll have a great Christmas.
We're knights of the round table. We dance when we're able. We do routine to